Good evening, I'm Judy Woodruff. On the NewsHour tonight, the war grinds on. Russian forces continue to bombard Mariupol and now the port city of Odessa, but are pushed back in northeast Ukraine, leaving ordinary citizens there to pick up the pieces. Then an uncertain future. A lawyer who argued against abortion rights before the Supreme Court discusses the justice's expected ruling to overturn Roe v. Wade. And Rethinking College, a Colorado institution reconfigures campus life to reckon with a troubling legacy of boarding schools that aim to erase indigenous students' way of life.
I feel more acknowledged on this campus rather than how it was before, where it's just like, oh, there's just some Indian kids over there, you know, they're not doing nothing.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Congress is considering a new aid package for Ukraine tonight, including an additional $40 billion in weaponry and economic and humanitarian assistance. This comes as top intelligence officials told senators today that Russia's President Putin is aiming for a longer, wider war, not just in the eastern Donbass, but with further flashpoints along Ukraine's southern coast. National Intelligence Director Avril Haines warned that such plans could push the conflict down a devastating new path.
The uncertain nature of the battle, which is developing into a war of attrition, combined with the reality that Putin faces a mismatch between his ambitions and Russia's current conventional military capabilities, likely means the next few months could see us moving along a more unpredictable and potentially escalatory trajectory.
Haines added that Putin seems to be counting on Western resolve to weaken over time. Also today, the Ukrainian government announced that Russia is withdrawing some, if not all, of its troops from the northeastern region around Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city and a crucial base for its military. The announcement comes after Ukrainian soldiers recently recaptured towns, including one east of the city, where Nick Schifrin reports tonight.
East of Kharkiv, Ukrainian soldiers are pushing forward. They patrol an area recently liberated from Russian troops, and now they're preparing for a counterattack. They build defensive positions, foxholes that will be linked to make a new line of trenches, made confident by recent success.
What is the threat from the Russians in this location?
Mostly it's the artillery and the artillery mortars. Also, this could be like a small recce groups, but like we're ready to engage.
Captain Jan Fitra's mission is to prevent Russian troops from moving through here south to the Donbass. Last week, they came under fire by Russian cluster bombs.
One of our soldiers died during the attack. Our medics tried to help him, but he was dead before the body hit the ground. Before we could take his body away, me and a few soldiers just spent a couple hours with his body, in that area.
Those woods in the front of us, they're shooting at us from there.
We first met then-Lieutenant Fitra in 2016 on the front line in eastern Ukraine, faced off against Russian-backed separatists.
How's your leg?
Could be better.
We met him again this past March, after he was shot through the leg defending Kyiv.
First 2 weeks when I was at the unit, I barely could walk, but I was working on it, and you see, I'm good right now.
Why or how are the Ukrainian forces around Kharkiv gaining such success right now?
Mostly the Russians, they're using right now mixed units. They're not organized, and that gives us more bigger opportunity to push them back. They don't calculate the fire, and our artillery, they can find the positions, calculate the fire, and just destroy their positions.
His men are a company in Ukraine's International Legion. They're all foreigners who write messages in their RPGs to the Russians they target and are paid and armed by the Ukrainian government. Some have faced combat, but never against a modern military. Steve is from Washington State.
There are a number of us here who've been in plenty of gunfights before, and we all said the same thing. Getting into a gunfight with another human being is a different animal. Here, there's no fighting back against death that falls from above.
How long will you stay?
As long as it takes. I'm here until we win.
You have two triggers.
They're just learning how to use the American anti-tank weapon, the Javelin, so effective because it can be used from cover quickly.
Fire, forget it, and that's all.
That's allowed Ukrainian soldiers to destroy hundreds of Russian tanks. They refer to this as a lollipop, the shape of a turret blown off the tank body. This is another village, Maloruhan, liberated a month ago. Today, Ukraine fires artillery from nearby, but hasn't cleaned up abandoned Russian barracks, with discarded Russian uniforms and even Russian borscht. The fields that residents used to till, the final resting place for a Russian helicopter. 81 years ago, the Nazis occupied Maloruhan. 2 months ago, the Russians occupied and tried to convince these villagers to go with them to Russia, including 48-year-old Oksana.
Why did you refuse their offer to go to Russia?
I don't know. I had a bad feeling because I didn't believe that Ukrainians would reach Russia without an incident. I didn't trust the Russians that I would be safe.
Do you ever get used to the sound?
No.
She walks me through the village past a destroyed car. You can still see the tracks of the tank that ran it over.
So what happened here?
She says a cluster bomb landed right outside their house, throwing shrapnel at the front door. She stayed, despite her husband's wanting to leave, because of her cats. They bear the wounds of this war, as do families that once considered themselves cross-border. Oksana was born in Russia and moved to Ukraine when she was 12.
I feel sorry for the Russians who did this to us. No one will respect them after what they have done. Even though I'm Russian myself, I don't know. It's hard to explain. Something feels wrong in my soul.
For weeks, Russia used Maloruhan to bombard Kharkiv, just 12 miles to the west. The fiercest fighting in this area took place in a village up the road, Vilhivka.
8,000 people used to live here. Now it is no more than 50. And even though the major fighting ended weeks ago, this place is a ghost town. There is literally nobody out on the streets, and parts of this village still smell acrid. You could still smell the war.
The Russian army didn't bother to pick up their dead. Dozens of homes took direct hits from Russian artillery. And in the street, leftover Russian munitions, just a few feet from the colored tires that outline a playground. In this village in ruins, we found Alexander. He grew up here and said he would never leave, no matter what.
What is life like here today? Is there any food? Is there any water?
Water? What water? Water, gas, electricity? The wires have been cut. What are you talking about? Food is scarce. Some people go to the city, some people share their food. Humanity is being tested.
So what happened here?
Down the road, Yaroslav Boderev shows me what used to be the back of his friend's home, blown out by an artillery shell just 2 weeks ago.
When the fighting was very heavy, people were hiding in the basements and had to take all their food with them. And at some point, I was living on the street, all by myself.
He's living here now, despite the damage, and he too vows to never leave.
I never could understand how people could live in Syria. They've had war for many years, and people just go about their lives. The same for us here. We got used to it. And now, when it's quiet, I have this strange feeling that something is missing.
A lot is missing here, including the children who used to fill the village's only school, now bombed and burned. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin in Vilhivka.
And a reminder that our coverage of Ukraine is supported in partnership with the Pulitzer Center. In the day's other news, President Biden defended his economic policies in the face of the worst inflation in the U.S. in 40 years. Instead, he blamed the pandemic, the war in Ukraine, and spending from the Trump era. The president said his proposals, from taxing billionaires to cutting drug prices, could help.
I think our policies help, not hurt. Think about what they say. The vast majority of the economists think that this is going to be a real tough problem to solve, but it's not because of spending. We've brought down the deficit.
Meanwhile, AAA reported that average gas prices nationwide are $1.40 higher than a year ago. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen argued today that abortion rights are key to economic health. She told senators that legalizing abortion helped women control their lives, go to school, and get jobs. She said if Roe versus Wade is overturned, it will damage the economy and set women back decades. The rate of gun killings in the U.S. jumped 35% in 2020, the most in more than 25 years. The CDC reports that total gun deaths topped more than 45,000. That is the most on record as the pandemic spread and firearm sales jumped. Gun homicide rates rose the most among young black men. They were 20 times more likely to be killed than young white men. The head of the World Health Organization today criticized China's no-tolerance approach to COVID-19. Under that policy, much of Shanghai has been locked down for nearly 6 weeks. But in Geneva, the WHO's director general said that strict quarantines are no longer the answer.
We don't think that it's sustainable, considering the behavior of the virus now and what we anticipate in the future, and especially when we have now a good knowledge, understanding of the virus, and when we have good tools to use.
Another top WHO official said that any benefits of a zero COVID policy must be weighed against damage to economies and human rights. In the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., son of the one-time dictator, called for unity after winning the presidency. He asked to be judged by his actions and not by his family history. But hundreds of students protested outside the election commission in Manila. Other activists charged that Marcos won because he whitewashed his history. South Korea's new president took office today. Conservative newcomer Yoon Suk-yeol was sworn in during a ceremony in Seoul. He campaigned on a harder line on North Korea and its nuclear weapons program. But today, he talked of conciliation.
If North Korea genuinely embarks on a process to complete denuclearization, we are prepared to work with the international community to present an audacious plan that will vastly strengthen North Korea's economy and improve the quality of life for its people.
Yoon also faces a struggle to right South Korea's economy after the pandemic. The British Parliament opened a new session today without Queen Elizabeth presiding for only the third time in her 70-year reign. Buckingham Palace blamed what it called her mobility issues. Instead, her son, Prince Charles, heir to the throne, stood in. He read the Queen's speech detailing the government's agenda for the coming year. Back in this country, a Boston city judge acquitted celebrity chef Mario Batali of indecent assault and battery. His accuser said that Batali forcibly kissed and groped her in 2017. She was one of four women who accused him of inappropriate touching. Batali apologized but denied any criminal wrongdoing. On Wall Street, blue chips were down, tech stocks were up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 85 points to close 32,160. The Nasdaq rose 114 points, that's 1%. The S&P 500 added 9. And a new record for American art. Andy Warhol's 1964 silkscreen of Marilyn Monroe, titled Shot Sage Blue Marilyn, sold Monday for $195 million. Christie's Auction House in New York says that it is the highest bid for any work by an American artist ever. There is no word on the identity of the buyer. Still to come on the NewsHour, former Secretary of Defense Mark Esper discusses his fraught relationship with former President Trump. India suffers an earlier-than-usual heat wave with major implications for agriculture. A highly contagious strain of bird flu plagues farmers across the U.S. and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
It's been a week since a leaked draft of a Supreme Court opinion showed the justices do appear poised to overturn 50 years of precedent on abortion access. And with the rest of the court's term measured in weeks, advocates on both sides are turning up the pressure. John Yang has more.
Judy, following protests outside the homes of conservative justices, Congress is considering a bill to provide security for their families. Last night, dozens of people marched outside the home of Samuel Alito, the author of the leaked draft opinion that could result in the biggest change to abortion rights since the 1992 case Planned Parenthood v. Casey. That decision reaffirmed the right to an abortion while allowing some restrictions. At the time, Ernest Prieto was Pennsylvania Attorney General, and he argued that case, asking the court to overturn Roe. Mr. Prieto joins us now. Mr. Prieto, first of all, I want to ask your reaction to the leaked draft opinion from last week.
It's a terrible thing. It affects the integrity of the court. I've been practicing over 50 years, and I've never seen a draft opinion leaked at any court level, local courts, state courts, or national courts. Just doesn't happen. So this really has to be investigated and investigated thoroughly.
And I want to stress, you're saying that when you say it's a terrible thing, it's the leak itself, not the outcome, the proposed outcome in the draft.
Well, there's two things. One is the leak, which is bad, and the second thing is the opinion, whatever it's going to be. I don't know what the opinion's going to be. We still don't have the official opinion of the court yet. I think it's a little speculative to say that it's going to be this one way or the other. But the fact of the matter is that we've seen some indications from the draft, which is a February 10th draft, that there's a tendency there to overturn Roe. Now, the actual vote doesn't occur until the end of June. That's when the opinion is released. The actual opinion of the court is released. So let's calm down a little bit and let's wait and see what they say.
And your experience in Casey is you know that there can be a change from the first draft opinion.
Absolutely. The Chief Justice changed his mind at the last minute. We were going to have all the Pennsylvania statute upheld, but the Chief Justice changed his vote in the last day or two before the opinion was announced. So come on, folks, let's relax. Let's see what happens.
How likely do you think it will be that the outcome of this opinion will change, that they will not overturn Roe?
Well, I don't know what to speculate on that. I argued for the overturning of Roe in 1992 when I represented Governor Casey in the Commonwealth before the court, and the governor sat right behind me. So it's not unheard of that where people are asking for overturning Roe. We asked for it in the 1992 case. We didn't get it. What we got was the gutting of Roe, legally gutting, because it took the strict scrutiny standard and eliminated that, put an undue burden standard for review in, and it took the trimester system out and put the viability standard in, which is what this is all about. And Dobbs is a viability standard. The viability standard then was 23, 24 weeks. We can get the viability at maybe 17 weeks, Mississippi saying 15 weeks. So that's where this battle is over.
Yesterday, we interviewed the opposing counsel in Casey, Catherine Colbert. I want to play a little bit of what she said and get your reaction.
We have had 5 decades of support for Roe versus Wade, and then entire generations of women in this country have relied upon this decision and, frankly, ordered their lives. Millions of women have obtained abortions as a result of Roe, and all of that is being rolled back because 5 individuals decided, in my view, willy-nilly to change the law. And I think that is a real hit on the institutional integrity of this court.
What do you say to that, Mr. Prieto?
Well, the case hasn't been overturned yet. Let's wait and see what the actual opinion of the court is going to be. But the fact of the matter is, there's always been a contest as to whether or not Roe was constitutionally properly decided from its inception, and whether or not there's a right to life or a right to abortion. And the only thing that I know in the Constitution is there's a right to life. I don't see written in the Constitution a right to an abortion. But that's going to be up to the states. If this opinion holds, it's not the end of abortions. It's the transference of the regulation of abortion to the states. And states are already doing it. New York, California, Virginia, and others are already putting forth state statutes, or have already put them forward, that regulate or allow abortions up until even moment of birth. So it's not the end of the world, but And the other thing that you have to recognize here is that we've got new science. The new science is that we can have a viability of the fetus that started 17 weeks, maybe 15 weeks. We also have the pill, abortion pills, which we didn't have then, and which are now almost half the abortions in America are done by pill. So, you know, let's take a look at what we've got, and I think we ought to start focusing on, let's get better care for women and children once the child is born. Let's have better instructions on what can we do about avoiding pregnancies, what can we do about taking care of women during pregnancies, and of course after pregnancies. We just wasted hundreds of billions of dollars in the PPP program, just willy-nilly threw it away. Wouldn't it be wonderful to take $100 billion of that and use it to help people and keep families together and safe and healthy?
The argument, you talked about rights not found in the Constitution, that the Supreme Court has ruled in the past that they do exist. Do you think Justice Alito's argument should apply to some of those, marriage, intimate sexual relations, contraceptives, purchasing contraceptives, that sort of thing? Do you think that this argument should apply?
No, I don't. Let's focus on one at a time. There was a debate as to whether or not there was a right. There's been a decision made in 1973 that there was a right. There's been a contest ever since that there wasn't a right. So let's wait and see what the Supreme Court says on the case itself, and then we'll take it from there as to whether it's going to apply to any other thing. I doubt it. I doubt it. But that I don't want to get into that speculative game and hysteria. Let's just wait until the end of June when the decision comes down and see what the court says.
Former Pennsylvania Attorney General Ernest Preet, thank you very much.
Thank you.
During the 18 months that Mark Esper served as Secretary of Defense, he clashed at times with former President Trump over proposals to use the military in ways Esper thought were inappropriate. Trump fired Esper in November 2020, a few days after Trump lost re-election. I sat down with Esper yesterday to discuss his experiences, which he details in a new book, A Sacred Oath, Memoirs of a Secretary of Defense During Extraordinary Times. Mark Esper, thank you very much for joining us. In this book, I think there's so many questionable, even astonishing ideas that you write about that emerged from either former President Trump or the people around him that it was hard to keep track of them all. I wrote down firing missiles from the U.S. into Mexico to go after the drug cartels, striking Iran, sending 250,000 U.S. troops to the southern border. How is it that none of these actually came to happen?
Well, I think, Judy, that there were myself and others in the cabinet who successfully at times, either individually or together, were able to talk the president and others out of these ideas, which we thought just didn't make sense and could end up doing more harm than good.
In particular, I mean, you opened the book with June the 1st, 2020. This is in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd, when there had been protests in Washington. And there's a meeting in the White House where former President Trump is asking you and others to do something about it. Tell us about that particular day, that meeting.
Well, as I recount in the book, General Milley and I get called to the White House early that morning, and we report in, and people are already assembled. And almost immediately, the president begins, you know, shouting that he's very irate that the protests were occurring and that, so much was happening. And it was true that we did have violence taking place. People were hurt, you know, park police, National Guard. And it seemed to be that violence was breaking out, at least to him, all around the country as well. And so his frustration, really grew to the point where he was talking about invocation of the Insurrection Act and the deployment of 10,000 active duty troops into the streets of the nation's capital. And it was at that point in time that I, Bill Barr, and with General Milley's assistance as well, began pushing back on that notion. And my view was that this was a law enforcement problem, that the military, the National Guard, could support and should support as needed. But this was a law enforcement issue, certainly not a matter for the active duty forces to be involved in.
But at the time, the public didn't know exactly what the president was asking for. He also, as you say in the book, in your opening page, was saying, why can't you just go out and shoot the protesters in the legs? It was later on that you and General Milley and others walked with the president over across Lafayette Square, stood in front of the church there. He was holding the Bible. What was going on in your mind at that time?
Look, it was obviously a very shocking and troubling remark for the president to suggest that we shoot protesters, we shoot Americans in the streets of the nation's capital. And needless to say, I and I suspect others there were all taken aback by that notion and successfully were able to push back on that and come up with, you know, a proposal that didn't call for that. But, you know, clearly it took hold of us for the day, if you will, and it obviously led to my mistake in terms of walking across Lafayette Park. And I think General Milley feels the same way as well.
What do you say, Mark Esper, to those who look at what happened that day and what the president was suggesting and say you should have spoken up at that moment and you should have even resigned your position?
Oh, boy, look, it's a great comment. And I wrestled with this constantly about what to do. And you got to keep in mind the context because it always matters. It was in the weeks and months leading up to this that other proposals were put forward, such as shooting missiles into Mexico, the deployment of 250,000 troops to the border, possible strikes against Venezuela. And each of these I was able, with the help of others at times, to kind of push back on. And my view was that, look, I thought I was serving the country better by staying in the job than by resigning. And then, of course, I had no idea who he would put in behind me. And that was my bigger concern was, would the president put in an uber loyalist who would really carry out these ideas that he and others were putting forward? And I still wrestle with it nonetheless. It's a lesson. It's something that I want people to think about and take from this book.
I've seen that some people have said why you had watched this president. You had seen what happened to your predecessor, James Mattis. Why did you take the job in the first place?
Well, look, I've been serving my country since the age of 18 when I went to West Point. I served 10 years in the Army, both during war and peace, and then another 11 years in the National Guard. I worked on Capitol Hill. Look, I believe in service to country, and I thought I could make a difference, and I do think I made a difference. I think all the great people I had the honor of working with at the Pentagon really served their oath honorably, and that was my view, is if the nation calls, I think we should all serve. And look, at the bottom line is, Judy, if good people don't serve, then you're left with the bad people, and that's not what our nation needs, particularly now in this era of extreme partisanship from both sides. We need good people to serve in government, to stay in government, and do the right thing.
But you had seen how he operated as president, and you still went to work for him, and you stayed with him for 18 months.
I was serving the Constitution. I was obeying my oath. I didn't work necessarily for the president or for the party or for a certain philosophy. My duty, my oath, was to the Constitution. Hence the name of my book. And to me, that's the important thing.
You do write in the book, Mark Esper, that you said the most shocking and troubling event of the Trump presidency was the, quote, organization and incitement of the pro-Trump mob that attacked the U.S. Capitol. As you know, we know he was impeached for that. Should he have been convicted, do you think, by the Senate?
I'd obviously like to see the Senate have a hearing and tease that out. But to me, it was a very troubling event, a moment. It was an insurrection. An attempt to overturn a free and fair election and to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. And it was right to be impeached. And he likely would have been convicted. I just don't know. But I'd want to see that trial play out.
Had you voted for him in 2016?
Yes, I did.
He is clearly thinking about running again. Is he qualified to be president again?
I hope he doesn't run for president. In my view, that any candidate for president from either party, by the way, should put country over self. They have to have, a level of integrity and principle that will carry them forward. They got to be willing to reach across the aisle and work with others. And President Trump just doesn't meet those marks for me.
I do want to read you, Mark Esper, some of what President Trump has said in the last 24 hours since some of your comments have come out. He has said, quote, you were a lightweight, a figurehead. He said Mark Esper was weak, totally ineffective. He said he would do anything I wanted.
Well, clearly I didn't do anything he wanted. And if you recall, I think another author published a story where President Trump's head of personnel put forward a 2-page memo outlining all the reasons why I should be fired because I didn't agree with the president or I disagree with him and push back. And look, that's the bottom line is I would expect no less from the president to do some degree of name calling and bad mouthing. But that's fine. Look, people will make their own decisions about him, about me, and about who's telling the truth. And look, what I'm trying to do is tell an important story for the American people, for history, about a very tumultuous and consequential time in our nation. And that's the purpose behind me writing this book.
Mark Esper, the book is A Sacred Oath, Memoirs of a Secretary of Defense During Extraordinary Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy.
Extreme heat is gripping large parts of India and Pakistan, affecting hundreds of millions of people in one of the most densely populated parts of the world. Temperatures in India's capital rose above 100 again today. Fred DeSam Lazaro reports from India.
May is the hottest month in India, a time when schools are out and kids learn various ways to cope with the stifling heat, like sharing this muddy pond with the water buffalo.
It is too hot inside. The water has stopped coming to our house. My mother told me to go to the pond and take a bath.
For many mothers, the daily routine makes it difficult to escape.
It's really hot here. When I cook, I get flashes of heat from the stove. It's hot even in the shade.
Temperatures like these are not unusual for May, but this year they came early, really early, and across a much wider swath of the country.
It is the hottest April in 122 years. March was the hottest March in 122 years.
I met Urmi Goswami, a journalist covering climate issues for India's Economic Times in one of Delhi's poorer neighborhoods.
It is getting hotter. You're building more. There are more cars on the street. There are all kinds of other things that are happening. Water stress is increasing. So clearly the factors that add to your discomfort are growing. I mean, just look around. You'll see the kind of housing that you have. It's not really conducive to any weather.
Only about a tenth of Indian households have access to air conditioning. But the sharp spike in electricity demand due to the heat wave has caused rolling blackouts. That stops the ceiling fans, sometimes for hours each day, the one coping mechanism for many lower-income people. The heat has been particularly stressful for those who labor outdoors.
I was working every day last week, even though it was making me sick. My eyes were getting red. That's why I stopped working today.
It's hard to measure the full toll on human health from all of this heat. Several dozen deaths have been reported as a direct result of heat stroke, but that doesn't take into account the many deaths that go unrecorded and long-term consequences of sustained heat exposure, like cardiovascular disease, respiratory distress, and liver and kidney failure.
The government has implemented early weather warnings that have allowed local municipalities to provide shelter, water, and relief. But for many day laborers in India's economy, to get paid, they have to go to work.
It's severely hot. If I work 10 minutes, I have to sit for half an hour to take a rest. It's so severely hot, I feel like I could faint.
Extreme heat, more than anything else, impacts productivity. And that itself is an issue when it comes to economic output.
That's especially true and worrying in agriculture, where the searing temperatures damaged this spring's wheat crop. At this market just outside Delhi, farmer Raghubir Singh Khatri showed us the difference between this year's crop and the last year's.
If it wasn't for the extreme heat in March, we would have had 20% more harvest. The grains are smaller this year. If temperatures were cooler, they would have looked bigger, like these.
That definitely has an impact on the quality of the production and the nutrition aspect of the wheat. And I think that will affect sale value of the crop itself.
Suricha Badwal, a climate scientist at the Energy and Resources Institute in Delhi, says there's no imminent danger of food shortages, India still has substantial reserve stocks and a free food distribution for low-income households that began during the pandemic. But as India and so many countries lurch from one extreme weather event to the next, Badwal says these become ever louder warnings of a climate catastrophe absent global action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
So no country is spared from the ill effects of the consequences of climate change, whether it's floods or cyclones or tornadoes or storm surges or heat waves. You know, today we are facing it. So we do need very stringent action to make sure that, you know, we are not converting this world into an uninhabitable place to live in.
Yet India's heat wave illustrates the difficulties countries have in living up to their goals to transition to cleaner energy, says journalist Goswami.
Look what happens at the first sign of a crisis. You go running back to what you know best to meet your demand, what you can do quickly.
Which is coal.
Is the transition easy? No. Is it necessary? It's essential. It's critical.
Today, 70% of India's power supply comes from coal, and it's had to step up production and imports of the polluting fuel to cope with the surge in heatwave-driven demand. On a more hopeful note, the June monsoon is forecast to be normal this year. For a billion people across the subcontinent, June and that rain cannot come quickly enough. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro in New Delhi.
And a note that Fred's reporting is in partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. The United States is in the midst of its worst bird flu outbreak in years. Millions of poultry and wild birds have been killed. And although the risk to human health is low, the impacts are trickling down to consumers. William Brangham recently traveled to the Midwest, where producers and scientists are desperately trying to stay ahead of the virus. And a warning, some viewers might find images in this story disturbing.
This is the only way to get into the barn.
For Minnesota turkey farmer John Zimmerman, there are some added costs of doing business these days.
This is the dirty side, and anything from past that mark is considered clean inside the barn.
So every time Zimmerman or one of his employees enters this barn, home to some 7,500 turkeys, they have to put on fresh boots and coveralls, wash their hands, and slide on gloves. It's all meant to prevent the spread of a deadly avian influenza, or bird flu. This strain is so contagious that a single case found in any of his barns would likely force Zimmerman to kill his entire flock.
It's just a little bit more stressful now because that uncertainty of that virus can come in the morning the birds can be fine, and at night you're going to be picking up hundreds, if not thousands, of dead birds. And, you know, oh crap, what do I do now?
This new virus spread from migratory birds from Europe. Many birds carry flu viruses all the time, and it doesn't usually harm them. But sometimes, a strain can get passed to domestic birds, like chickens, ducks, or turkeys, and with the right mutation, can then spread like wildfire. In 2015, during the last big outbreak, more than 50 million birds were killed or died nationwide. With this new strain, over 37 million birds are dead across more than 30 states.
Every morning I get up and I look into the sky and make sure I don't see any ducks or geese flying overhead, and then we check our barns on our...
Because if you see ducks or geese flying overhead, they could be dropping feces...
Correct.
...that might be loaded with virus.
Yes, it gets to be a knee-jerk reaction, and you do it, you know, no matter... Since 2015, my son is 7 years old, and he knows Daddy does not like ducks and geese, and they're the worst animals in the world, and he's growing up with... duck bad, goose bad, so it's kind of ingrained in me to watch for that from now on, I think.
This flu strain is so contagious that it could even enter a closed barn, traveling on airborne bits of dust or dirt, leaving farmers like Zimmerman always on edge.
In the morning, you go check your barns, and you make sure your mortality's not up, and the birds are healthy and active, and you breathe a sigh of relief that you've made it through another night.
But what happens when farmers do see signs that their birds might be sick? Here at the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab, scientists test about 100 samples a day for bird flu using the same PCR process used for COVID tests. Jerry Torreson directs the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab at the University of Minnesota, which jointly runs this facility with the state.
Producers, veterinarians, animal health regulatory people have to decide the fate of a flock of birds. They have to decide if it's negative, it's business as usual. If it tests positive, if they have flu, then that flock is depopulated. And they want to make those decisions as soon as they possibly can so that everybody can respond accordingly.
The state expanded this lab in the heart of Minnesota's turkey country after the 2015 outbreak. It's part of a nationwide network of labs tracking bird flu, with positive results reported to the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
It's like we're in the fire watchtower and watching the lightning strikes hit out in the forest, and so we're the fire spotters. And that's different this year in that there are so many more premises. There are actually more sites, more flocks already this year than there were in 2015.
Right now, there's no evidence this flu is a danger to humans. Last month, an inmate in Colorado did test positive for the virus after helping remove chickens from an infected barn, but he's recovered, and officials stressed that risk remains very low. Perhaps the greater impact of this outbreak on humans is to their wallets.
Chicken and turkey prices are about 20 to 30% higher. Egg prices are actually up almost double since the same time last year.
Jason Lusk is an agricultural economist at Purdue University. While the flu outbreak plays a role in higher prices, Lusk says so do other factors like supply chain issues and rising feed costs driven partly by the war in Ukraine.
While it's true that a very large number of birds have been affected by bird flu, they represent a very small share of the overall inventory. But if you're a producer that's been hit by bird flu, it can be devastating.
This virus is also proving deadly to certain wild birds, like this eagle, who've been hit much harder by this strain than in past outbreaks.
We've never seen this before.
Dr. Victoria Hall directs the University of Minnesota's Raptor Center. Well over 100 raptors have come into the center suffering with avian flu, seizing, unable to stand, unresponsive. Only one lucky owl, which may have had a lower viral load, has survived so far. It's not clear why this year's outbreak is so much worse for wild birds than in 2015. Back then, not a single raptor at the center tested positive.
We know there's species like bald eagles that have made a comeback historically. Now they're still challenged with things like lead poisoning. What happens when you add highly pathogenic avian influenza on top of that?
Another difference this year, many more backyard flocks have been hit by the virus compared to 2015.
Welcome to the coop.
Stacy DeCourcy started with three chickens at her house in suburban Minneapolis about 7 years ago. She's lost count of how many chickens, turkeys, and ducks she has, even though she knows all their names.
Jangles, that's Chevy Chase, Scarlett Johansson.
And as I learned with the big gray turkey Hermione,
oh, hello.
They're very happy to be with humans. While DeCourcy can't implement the same so-called biosecurity as a commercial producer does, her birds were healthy before, during, and after our visit. To avoid attracting any migratory birds, she's not leaving food or water outside, but she doesn't have the space to keep her birds cooped up indoors.
It's stressful. I know I lost sleep the first two weeks, and then, you know, my grandpa, farmer from Iowa, that just kicks in, and it's a farm animal. And it's a bird, and we can rebuild. I certainly feel really bad for those who their livelihood depends on their flocks.
While affected farmers are eligible for some compensation from the federal government, John Zimmerman says recovery is not that simple.
You put a lot of time and energy, your heart and soul, into raising these birds, and the fact that you have to destroy that is incredibly tough. Now, we understand we're doing that, we're euthanizing these birds to save other birds, but it's incredibly difficult. And it's emotionally, physically, and mentally devastating to the farmers that they have to do that.
So for now, he's keeping everything as clean as possible, watching the skies closely, and hoping he makes it through this outbreak. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham in Minnesota.
Over the course of more than 100 years, beginning in the 1800s, hundreds of thousands of Native American children in the U.S. were removed from their families, placed in federal boarding schools, and forced to abandon their native languages and culture. One college in Colorado, which is also one of the top Native American degree-conferring institutions in the country, is reckoning with that history. Special correspondent Hari Srinivasan reports for our Rethinking College series.
On a recent evening, the pounding of drums signaled the start of an annual tradition at Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado. After a two-year hiatus due to the pandemic, a sold-out crowd packed the stands to watch the powwow, which dates back to the 1960s. While the mood was celebratory, the night's theme was somber, remembering those who never made it home. Those being honored? The unknown number of Native American children who died at Indian boarding schools around the country, including one with a historical connection to this college.
There has been a huge reckoning in this country to say that institutions must take a look at their own racialized history and understand the implications of that racialized history. For Fort Lewis College, that racialized history is embedded in the fact that we started as an Indian boarding school.
Tom Stridicus is the president of Fort Lewis College. Over the last 3 years, the school has been engaged in an effort to explore and acknowledge that history and provide a more supportive learning environment for Native American and Alaska Native students who make up about half of the school's enrollment. Stridicus says over the years, the college's history and long-standing Native American tuition waiver weren't a secret, but they also weren't widely understood by the campus community.
Native American tuition waivers, it's actually connected to the fact that the students who are attending today potentially had ancestors who were abused and traumatized by Native American boarding schools. Those things are connected. Indigenous communities paid a tremendous price because of federal Indian boarding schools.
This is the original boarding school site, a rural stretch of land about 15 miles from the Fort Lewis College campus, which moved to the current location in the 1950s. Today, the land is used by the college for agricultural education. Only two of the original buildings remain.
For nearly 20 years, between 1891 and 1910, thousands of Native American children came to a boarding school here. They were stripped of their language, their culture, and frankly, their identity. The impacts of that cultural genocide are still being felt today.
My father grew up not learning the Dakota language because his parents made a difficult decision that my dad would be better served if he just spoke English without any accent. Many descendants of boarding school survivors know that experience.
Fort Lewis College Associate Professor Majel Boxer's grandparents attended boarding schools in other locations around the country. She's an enrolled member of the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux tribes of northeastern Montana. Her research is focused on the history of the boarding school, which was called the Fort Lewis Indian School.
This building here served agricultural purposes.
While the original boarding school grounds have not yet been searched for unmarked graves, a bill has been introduced in the Colorado legislature that would fund culturally appropriate exploration later this year. Boxer says that process will be an important part of the healing.
The stories that are shared with me by Ute tribal elders are that they know children have passed away, and so part of that reconciliation includes that truth-telling.
The campus-wide reconciliation process now underway is due in large part to this woman.
I'm Jocelyn Lee, and I am assistant professor of chemistry here at Fort Lewis College. I am enrolled for the Pueblo of Laguna. They are one of the 19 tribes of New Mexico.
As a student at Fort Lewis College in the early 2000s and returning as a new faculty member in 2019, she was troubled by panels under the college's prominent clock tower that depicted the school's boarding school history and captions that included, quote, "The children are well clothed and happy."
So I did get upset again of this is an inappropriate representation, and I'm not too sure why we're still allowing that to be shared.
She sent an email to President Stridicus about her concerns in August of 2019, and he agreed. The Fort Lewis College History Committee was soon formed to begin a concerned introspection of the school's boarding school history. One big step in that process was removing the boarding school panels during a special ceremony last year.
It felt good to be listened to after raising the concern than to have our college president just simply say, you're right, let's remove them. And then we spent a good year in town halls to see how we could improve our campus and our understanding of the Indian school history.
Other new efforts include an Indigenous language revitalization program, 3 new faculty hires in the Native American and Indigenous Studies department, and a land acknowledgement before college events and in classes at the start of each semester.
Good evening, everybody. The land that we gather on tonight here at Fort Lewis College is situated upon the ancestral homelands and territories of the Nuchu people who were forcibly removed by the United States government.
Senior Noah Shadlow, an enrolled member of the Osage Nation, says he's seen a change in the campus culture since reconciliation began.
I feel more recognized. I feel more acknowledged on this campus rather than how it was before, where it's just like, oh, there's just some Indian kids over there. You know, they're not doing nothing.
But he says there is still work to be done.
I would like to see more Indigenous staff here on campus. A big thing that we need here is Indigenous counselor. It's kind of hard to talk with a counselor who doesn't, you know, share your cultural identity.
For President Stridicus, a big part of the work still to be done is getting students across the finish line. The college's 6-year graduation rate for Native American students is about 30%, slightly below the national rate. Before the pandemic, the school was starting to see some gains in first-year retention rates.
The pandemic has definitely eroded those gains, but I think that when we put the notions around academic support together with sort of the broad, culturally responsive work we're doing in terms of acknowledging the importance of Native culture, we'll pick back up the gains that we started to see before the pandemic.
For Jocelyn Lee, the work over the last few years has been meaningful.
I think this has opened up a lot of discussion on how we can start to learn more about each other's culture. So I'm hoping that this is a more holistic approach to learning about each other so that we can all start to get along better.
There's been a steady uptick in the number of Native American students enrolling over the last 4 years, and the college expects a record number of applications this spring. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Hari Srinivasan in Durango, Colorado.
So important to know that history. And later tonight on PBS, you can watch the season 3 premiere of Beyond the Canvas, hosted by Amna Nawaz. The show features interviews and profiles with some of the brightest stars in music, art, literature, and more. Tonight's episode focuses on the art all around us. Here's a sneak preview.
On Beyond the Canvas, we revisit artists finding ways to change the world around them.
When you take that brush to the canvas, you're looking for some sort of change.
Those waves, they are pretty tight one after another. I don't think I've ever been as nervous as a director.
For most people, the communities that are underrepresented in the outdoor community, Everest is untouchable.
Latinos have changed this quintessential American sport. That is a transformative moment.
You can watch the first of this season's 5 episodes starting tonight on most PBS stations. Check your local listings. And online right now, follow live coverage of the primary election results for key congressional and gubernatorial races in Nebraska and West Virginia. That is at pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.